Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Here are some articles from the February-March issue of Cowboys
Seeking Serenity. We offer some recollections of places and experiences in the West that quiet the mind and calm the spirit. Passing through Flint Hills of Kansas. Before we got married, young and naive, then got divorced, older and embittered, my first serious boyfriend and I fell in love in the outdoors. I came from native Chicagoans. He was descended from Missouri farmers. We found common ground in parks and pretty places, where we picnicked and played frisbee and began mistaking our attraction to nature as attraction to each other. We eventually left our Kansas homes to go to college together in California. On weekends, when we should have been studying, we would cross-country ski, river raft, backpack and beach comb from Yosemite, Death Valley, and Mendocino to Lake Tahoe, Point Reyes, and Big Sur. The Sierra Nevada, the Pacific Ocean, redwood forests, Mother Nature was everywhere flaunting her exhilarating beauty. There were meditative moments around campfires, at scenic outlooks, under the Milky Way, by the water's edge. There were glorious sunrises and sunsets coloring dramatic landscapes to otherworldly magnificence. But with the grandeur came miles to cover, switchbacks to climb, photos to take, and people to avoid, invariably slews of them with the same idea of finding some peace and quiet while preventing you from finding yours. There was no such problem in the Flint Hills of Kansas. There, tranquility flowed naturally from the unobstructed, undemanding landscape. Gentle undulations punctuated the occasional solitary tree, luscious green under the blue sky, glowing gold under orange sun. Intimations of serenity, if not immortality. I remember driving through once with my ex. In my mind, it's him, but it might have been high school best friend. In my heart's memory, though, I'm there with my first love. Maybe we'd been to the Midnight Donut place in the college town of Manhattan and stayed up all night waiting for the sun to come up. Like most people who live in Kansas, I, at least vaguely, knew about this special place that made an otherwise boring drive across the otherwise flat state interesting and even scenic. Wikipedia will tell you that explorer Zebulon Pike gave the Flint Hills their name when he noted in his journal in 1806 that he had passed very rough Flint Hills, the geologic insult of abundant residual flint eroded from the limestone bedrock that lies at or near the surface. Wikipedia will further tell you that the Flint Hills area is designated as its own distinct ecoregion because it has the densest coverage of intact tall grass prairie in North America. It will also tell you that what settlers found too rocky to farm, cattle ranchers have appreciated for the good grazing. It doesn't tell you this, but I will. There's something elemental here that you feel in your bones and your soul. And I don't think it's something only Midwesterners experience. The prairie could be the most American of our vastly varied landscapes. The Great Plains do indeed have a greatness and majesty. This is the heartland. Not just because it's interior from the coasts. The heart is more than geographic. In its emptiness, you might feel a fullness. In its timelessness, you might sense the bygone era when bison, elk, and prairie wolves roamed here. and the Kansas, Wichita, Osage, and Pawnee hunted, grew crops, and sometimes lived along the streams and creek. In its openness, you might imagine the waves of grass rolling for miles and miles beyond the precious bit that has been saved and restored. In its lonesomeness, you might find the peace and quiet you're looking for, and you just might remember a love that once seemed as boundless as the uncluttered horizon before you. Camping out in Big Bend, Texas. The campsite at Telephone Canyon feels like the loneliest place in the world. Just getting here does as much to wrap this backcountry jewel in mystique as do its sere surroundings. Visitors have to earn the privilege, which means first crossing 14 miles from the southern terminus to the spur that takes you to the canyon's camping sites. Of axle-torquing washouts and undercarriage-grinding bedrock. Only 14 miles, right? That's about the distance from my house in East Dallas to my favorite Oak Cliff Bar. But the journey along Big Bend National Park's Old Ore Road took me to at least three slow-going hours, probably not much faster than the mule and pack trains that once traversed the same general route in the early 1900s, while transporting ore from Mexican mines to the railroad station in Marathon. By the time I passed by minivans, boulders, long dislodged from their western cliff face, I knew I'd made it. The sun had gone down behind the mountains. The moonless dark was obliterating. The Milky Way, like a braid of dust arching through blackness. I was wiped. My pickup had a few new squeaks. I set up camp in headlight beams. Don't expect luxury. All you'll find out here is a bear box in a brush clearing. As I stepped out of my tent the next morning, I was almost startled. I'd been here for hours, yet I'd never actually seen it. To the east, the sheer limestone cliffs of the Dead Horse Mountains. In the west, a marscape of boulder-strewn hills, ferned with creosote and hedgehog cactus. To the south, the road that brought me, I walked up Telephone Canyon Trail into the eponymous canyon, the greens of the sotal and prickly pear looking preternaturally saturated at dawn. A faint footpath snaked between the pyramidal hills at the mountain's trailing edge. I wondered if I'd ever been anywhere so perfectly quiet. Tuning in, Santa Monica Mountains, California. Living in Los Angeles for any immoderate stretch of time, say 25 years, after a snap decision to do the only insensible thing after college and beeline to California from Toronto with a girlfriend, her two cats, a kitty litter scented Honda Civic, and a permanently evolving game plan, is bound to come with its share of ups and downs. Topographically speaking, the most stabilizing highs and lows for me along the way have been in the hills and canyons of the Santa Monica Mountains. LA's astonishing, massive, to the tune of over 153,000 acres, yet still somehow hidden expanse of wrinkled Mediterranean wildland running from Hollywood to Malibu and beyond, has been called the world's largest urban park by sources even more reliable than Wikipedia. Actually, it's several parks and preserves, consolidated by the National Park Service in 1978 into a national recreation area, mosaic of lonely sage-covered slopes, oak and sycamore-shaded canyons, secret waterfalls, an historic Western movie set, iconic amphitheaters and observatories, retired ranches, the Will Rogers Polo Grounds, endless tide pool-studded beaches, and more than 500 miles of vacant enough hiking trails to happily reconform that nobody walks in L.A. I've camped out here with my kids on these beaches and in these hills and leafy gullies for a dozen straight summers. I watched them strike their first matches and construct their first s'mores in Leo Carrillo and Malibu Creek State Parks, and portray their first drunk outlaws at ages 9 and 4 outside the fake saloon at Paramount Ranch. I witnessed them take their first real wave at Zuma Beach, explore their first tide pools at Point Mugu, and ruthlessly critique their dad's lamely improvised ghost stories under a totally unscary Milky Way, all before growing up a bit too fast. Recently, during a solo hike on the Rising Sun Trail at Solstice Canyon in the hills above Malibu, with a sweep Pacific backdrop, I spied my first baby red-tailed hawk teaching itself to fly, flapping, 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 then soaring off quasi-confidently on its maiden voyage. I'll spare you the more sentimental empty nest metaphors beyond that, but they're everywhere in those peaceful folds of L.A.'s best disappearing act. Still the most reliable place to step out and feel grateful to be here. Mushing Along, Fairbanks, Alaska. On assignment for a magazine, I once profiled two dog mushers and attended a dog mushing race, and I was baffled about why people involved in the sport were so passionate about something that, as far as I could tell, made you undeniably miserable. Dog mushing seemed like a sport in which all you did was freeze half to death while dogs barked like maniacs around you. It appeared to be peaceless physically, mentally, and emotionally. I figured I was missing something, so I signed up for a dog mushing class. When I arrived at just short of Magic, out in the country near Fairbanks, and stepped outside into the minus 22 degree morning, I smugly congratulated myself for being right all along. But I was wearing gear made for St. Louis, and just short of Magic owner Eleanor Wirtz wouldn't let me near a sled unless I donned her Alaska caliber gear. I zipped into a coat and boots, the cold disappeared, and I had my first indication that I was, indeed, missing something. I climbed aboard the sled. The dogs bolted as if for freedom. We hit the woods, and my attitude completely changed. The chaos of the dogs, of cold, of life, disappeared. Whatever troubles I brought with me evaporated like the vapor from the dogs' panting exhales. Nothing could chase, never mind catch, me out there. I marveled at the glory of sensory deprivation. There was no sound, save for an occasional gee and haw from Wirtz to get the dogs to turn. I saw just three colors, the white of the snow, the blue of the sky, and the dark gray of the trees. The only evidence that anything else in the world existed was the trail. After 30 minutes of the kind of tranquility I always crave but rarely acquire, we turned around and headed home. I returned Wirtz's gear, put mine on, and froze half to death as I walked to my car. Journeying Beyond, Sedona, Arizona. The name Mi Amo comes from a Native American phrase meaning one's path or one's journey. But for me, Mi Amo is about stillness. It's about a mind at rest, a soul at peace, and a spirit calmed. Maybe it's the massive red rock formation surrounding the Mi Amo Resort that makes me feel grounded. As people and cultures have come and gone over the centuries, the rocks have remained, their positions fixed, their ancient beauty never fading. The Yavapai Apache consider Boynton Canyon a sacred site, and I'd be hard-pressed to argue with them. So yes, it could be the location, or it could be the resort itself. The 16 Casita all-inclusive destination spa has 3, 4, or 7-night journeys customized for each guest, with treatments including facials, massages, spiritual healing rituals, and Native American-inspired therapies, all performed by some of the spa industry's best practitioners. So again, it could be the majestic setting, or it could be the award-winning 24,000-square-foot spa. But it could be another thing, too, something that some might actually consider a shortcoming. Cell service in the canyon is nearly non-existent. If you can imagine a world without incessant ringing, beeping, and buzzing, that's what Miamo is like. Times are changing, though, and the resort has plans to launch an on-site cell tower, which is sure to improve reception, but with the tower comes temptation, the urge to keep tabs on your email, your voicemail, your social media. I suggest you squelch that desire and revel in the stillness instead. Gazing artfully, Fort Worth, Texas. Between the modernist building designed by renowned architect Philip Johnson and the Remingtons and Russells on view inside, about 400 pieces by them alone, and wonderful works by many more artists, you're in a dream intersection of Old and New West at the Amon Carter Museum of American Art. You'll discover stunning 19th and 20th century paintings and sculptures, as well as one of the country's great collections of American photography. Wherever you wander and stop to gaze, at a masterpiece or at the panoramic views of downtown Fort Worth from the museum's lovely grounds in the city's cultural district, you'll be immersed in Western reverie for hours on end. Going Wildlife, Jackson, Wyoming. A trip to the National Museum of Wildlife Art really puts you in touch with wildlife, inside its walls and out. Built to blend in with the landscape, the museum has animal bronzes scattered around the property. Inside, the amazing permanent collection includes thousands of works depicting wildlife in all kinds of styles and mediums. Everything from frontier-era paintings by Albert Bierstadt to outsider art by Bill Traylor to contemporary animal portraits by John Nieto. The artwork can excite you and lull you at the same time. But my favorite thing for delivering tranquil moments is viewing the Sleeping Indian, Sheep Mountain, and the National Elk Refuge, which the museum overlooks. There's a live webcam trained on the refuge. If you're lucky, you might see elk, coyotes, foxes, moose, bald eagles, raven, red-tailed hawks, ermine, marmots, swans, and even wolves. Surrendering spiritually, Taos, New Mexico. The town of Taos never fails to transport you to a calming parallel plane, and El Monte Sagrado accentuates that feeling. The name itself, the Sacred Mountain, sets the tone for something special and magically mystical at this living resort and spa property. You can't help but deeply connect with nature in a spiritual way here. The vibe is both grounded and floating, homey and hallowed. Waterfalls and wildflowers, leafy trees and earthy adobes, sacred circles and super happy hours. If there's such a thing as finding the cozy zen of walking the natural path, this is the place to experience it. Glamping gloriously, Black Hills National Forest, South Dakota. It takes only as long as getting your suitcase stowed when you arrive at Under Canvas Mountain Rushmore to start feeling the shift. You're staying on what was originally a gold mining settlement in an upscale prospector tent less than 4 miles from Mount Rushmore National Memorial. Under Canvas has other locations in the west. This one is situated in Black Hills National Forest among ponderosa pines. You can head deep into the Black Hills and explore Custer State Park. Or you can unwind in the pine-scented joy of your lantern-lit tent and lounge on your deck with a glass of wine and a binocular view of Mount Rushmore lit up at night. Whatever you choose, you'll be breathing deeper and feeling peace pervade. Paddling away, Vail, Colorado. You'd think nearly an hour in the hands of a professional masseuse would be the epitome of tranquility. My press visit to Four Seasons Resort and Residence Vail had included a recharging 50-minute massage at the hotel's Vail Spa, as well as a relaxing but action-packed guided fly fishing trip via Gore Creek Fly Fisherman, and some incredible meals at the hotel. German food at Almresi Vail, and Italian at La Nona Ristorante Vail. Just sitting on the patio of my lushly appointed room and enjoying the night breeze was calming. But it was during some time-killing post-hike canoeing that I felt the closest thing to Zen someone wound as tightly as me can enjoy. That morning, we had made a 6-mile round-trip hike from Piney River Ranch at the foot of the Goer Range up to Piney Falls, where we had a snack and enjoyed the view and refreshing waterfall spray. The trail is rated as moderate, but even at the high altitude, not even the low-altitude dwellers in our group seemed to struggle too much to enjoy the scenery and the steady stream of dogs passing by in both directions, about one canine for every 3 or 4 humans on the well-trafficked path. After lunch and a quick tour of the spacious yurts being used for a wedding party, we had some time left. Another rider and I borrowed a canoe and took it out on the little lake. The water had been glassy smooth and clear when the sun was still low in the sky, but the wind had picked up a little by the afternoon. We paddled in an aimless, roughly clockwise circumnavigation of the lake, not talking, just enjoying the quiet and the beautiful blue sky and the wares we had purchased on the edge of town. No itinerary action items, no place to be for a while, just the gentle lapping against the hull and the splish of our paddle blades cutting the water's surface as we glided across the lake. Distant voices broke our reverie. We turned and saw a dozen or so people in formal attire about 100 yards away at the edge of the lake, all watching us. Just past them, a photographer behind a camera on a tripod cocked his head and raised his palms in a "dude, what the hell?" gesture. Oblivious, we had floated into the background of the wedding party's photo shoot. We cackled and then leaned into fast, efficient strokes, each paddling as hard as he could when not doubled over with laughter, almost in tears, giggling and riffing about how furious they must have been, how many of their tightly scheduled minutes we had wasted by just drifting into the shot. One of us checked his smartphone clock and saw we needed to go, so we piloted to shore, tossed a line to a waiting canoe rental employee, and clambered onto the dock. It was time for our next activity. Trekking on, Santa Fe. The first time we hiked the Borrego Bear Walla Windsor Triangle Trail, or the bear, as I nicknamed it for my hiking partner, my Australian shepherd, Rose, I knew it was a keeper. Just 15 minutes outside of Santa Fe, tucked off the Hyde Park Road on the way to the ski mountain, the bear was like stepping off into the mystical world of tall trees and sweet silence, which was only occasionally interrupted by great whooshes of the wind, depending on the season. From the trailhead at the parking lot, the trail, a triangular loop of three different trails, immediately dove deep into a forest of aspen and fir. Easy for a while, the path dripped and curved, eventually crossing Tasuki Creek. Even though there was a bridge, for Rose and me, this part of our hike meant navigating logs or large rocks to get to the other side. If it was fall, the broad leaves of the white-trunked aspen glowed brilliantly yellow against the crisp blue sky and trembled in the mountain breeze. It felt like walking through a landscape that could only be imagined by an artist using colors too saturated to be real. In the winter, we happily tromped along the trail in snow and ice. In spring and summer, blankets of wildflowers spread in wide open meadows alongside the creek. If you asked Rose, she would probably tell you the creek was her favorite part, because that was where the big pine trees were. She'd bring me a pine cone, drop it at my feet, and then bark until I did what she wanted. I'd throw the pine cone into the water, and she'd run down after it, nosing around while standing in water that nearly covered her. Then she'd come back with it so we could do it all over again. Toward the end of the trail, there was one steep, relentless climb with switchbacks and altitude so that no stairmaster could replicate it. I hated it. I loved it. It was everything, the bear, a whole world of hiking from challenging to breezy, all in an hour and a half loop. It was our own little escape, just the two of us, usually with the trail all to ourselves. We never worried too much about why it was called Bear Wallow until the time we saw a sign at the trailhead warning hikers that a black bear and her cubs had recently been spotted. I remember that was a pretty good pine cone tossing day. Hiding out, Sonora, Texas. As someone who's lived in the state all her life, it's possible I'm a little biased when I say there is nothing quite like the Texas sky. The 5 hours it takes me to drive from Dallas to Sonora remind me of this fact as the sun beats down and the miles of roads ahead of me disappear into bright, bright blue. Arriving at J.L. Barr Ranch Resort and Spa in the Texas Hill Country is like entering a bubble of luxury and hiding out from the rest of the world. The rustic main lodge and private villas sit atop a hill overlooking the pool, which adds a blissful running water sound effect, and thousands of acres of rustling trees stretching from east to west. In the morning, I step out onto the porch of my villa with a cup of hot coffee, listening to the crescendos of the birds as the world awakens. That sky I love so much is a hazy blue and gold gradient, and the winds sweeping in from northern Mexico make me wish I'd grabbed my sweater, even in late June. At night, the walk back from a full day of food and excursions is under a blanket of stark indigo, studded with millions, if not billions, of white stars. I pause. I could spot the moving shadows of deer prancing across the property. Inside the villa, the bright, milky light of the moon cascades onto the floor from the skylight, wishing me a good night.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'll be reading the second half of the Western Magazine Hour, We're going back to True West Magazine's archives. I'll be reading from an issue published in February 1989. And by the way, at that time, the magazine cost $2.25. Our article is I Refound Stinking Springs by Alan Barker. A few days before Christmas in 1880, 13 grim horsemen rode silently as they could up Tyban Arroyo, 14 miles east of Fort Sumner, New Mexico Territory. It was bitter cold, and 2 hours after midnight, but the riders continued. They were following a trail in 3 inches of frozen snow that Billy the Kid, Dave Rudabaugh, Charles Boudre, Tom Pickett, and Billy Wilson had made at sundown the previous day. Pat Garrett, deputy sheriff from Lincoln County, and Frank Stewart, cattle agent and leader of the Texas Posse, knew their chances were good. There was nothing ahead but the staked plains of New Mexico and West Texas. With the tracking snow and nothing to hide behind but mesquite and bare grass, there was no way the outlaws could escape on their exhausted horses. Pat could nearly taste Governor Lew Wallace's $500 reward. Finally, Pat stopped to let the other lawmen gather around him. "Boys," he said in almost a whisper, "I think I know where they'll hole up. About a half mile ahead, there's an old rock house by Stinking Springs where their horses can drink. I think they'll sleep there. We'll ride on a ways, then leave Juan with the horses. The rest of us will go on afoot and surround the house. If they're there, we'll have them trapped." A half hour later, Pat and six of the posse crept up a smaller ravine and were behind its bank, covering the gaping doorway of the old house only 30 feet away. Stewart and his Texans were scattered behind the shack, wrapped in blankets like Comanches, and behind what cover they could find. Pat's guess had been right. The outlaws' tracks stopped at the house, and 3 horses were tied outside to its projecting rafters. The other 2 must have been taken inside with the 5 men for their body warmth. The posse's approach had been so stealthy that their tired horses had not been alarmed. It would be 3 hours until daylight, when the outlaws would likely emerge. Pat sent a messenger to the Texans to propose that they attack and surprise the outlaws in their sleep, but Stewart vetoed the idea. Maybe at daylight, when the outlaws found themselves surrounded, they would surrender without bloodshed. No one in the posse could remember a more miserable 3 hours. Young Charlie Rudolph got 1 foot so cold, the skin froze inside his boot. Pat, remembering his buffalo hunting tricks, was keeping his trigger finger under his left arm to keep it warm. Finally, there was a glow in the eastern sky, and the outlaws' horses became restless, stamping their feet on the hard frozen snow. Inside the house, someone ordered a horse to get the hell off my foot. The sounds in the house grew louder, and a man carrying a noose bag for his horse appeared in the doorway. Pat raised his rifle, and the men around him followed suit. Several rifles roared, and the man was thrown back into the house. Shortly, the man appeared again. His pistol had been buckled on and pulled around to his front. I wish, he repeated as he staggered across the 30 feet of snow toward the lawmen. Then he died and slid down the bank into their midst. It was Charlie Boudry. Then followed a period of derisive banter between the Kid and Pat Garrett. Pat wanted the outlaws to surrender. Billy was looking for a way to escape. Under cover of the talk, the outlaws reached a rope and tried to lead another horse into the building. If they could get enough horses inside, they could mount up and make a break for it. Some of Pat's men pointed to warn him, but he motioned them to silence. Just as the horse was entering the house, His rifle barked, and the horse dropped as though poleaxed. The lower third of the doorway was blocked with a half ton of horse meat that not even the kid could ride a horse over. Then Pat and his men drew the noose tighter by shooting the ropes that held the other two horses to the building. When the last frightened animal broke free, the posse knew it had won the fight. Pat took half of the posse back to Brazil's ranch to eat and warm up, while Stuart and his men held the siege. When Pat returned, he brought Brazil's wagon loaded with hay for the horses and dry firewood and food for the men. Soon, the smell of roasting beef and brewing coffee overpowered the outlaws' will to spend another night in the old house. There were negotiations in which Pat guaranteed no lynching and a safe passage through Las Vegas for Rudabaugh. Then the four outlaws threw out their guns and trooped outside past the blanket-covered body of Bowder to share the coffee, roast beef, and warm fire with their captors. That was the best I could do on an important part of The Story of Billy the Kid, a book I had been working on for 15 years. It only paraphrased what Pat Garrett and Ash Upson had written in 1882. If I could see the Rock House and the surrounding area personally, I might do better. My books and maps would tell me where Stinking Springs was. On my next research trip, I would go there, see it, and write the episode as it deserved. But my library on the kid did not help. One author said that Stinking Springs was 4 miles south of Tolar, an area I knew to be featureless. Most authors echoed William Kelscher, who said it was another name for Tyban Arroyo and that it was at Tyban. Now, people on the Staked Plains are not going to confuse springs with arroyos. They do not look alike. Arroyos, like highways and rivers, are never said to be at a small community. Then I found that the map at the front of Kelscher's otherwise excellent book has the Canandaigns drainage turning north at Tyban, not 3 miles to the east as it should. It does not show the larger Alamosa drainage at all. With a map like that, even Kelscher could go wrong. Then I found where he got the idea that Stinking Springs was another name for Tyban Arroyo, from the notoriously inaccurate Saga of Billy the Kid. So much for bookwork. On my next trip, I would have one of my uncles show me Stinking Springs. The summer of 1983 took me to Kidd County by way of Truth or Consequences to see my Uncle John. He had inherited the Dog Iron Ranch 10 miles south of Tyban from my grandfather and surely knew where Stinking Springs was. John showed his Indian more than my other relatives. In his youth, he had been tall and very straight, with a head of thick black hair. Whenever he lived, he was known for his hunting, fishing, and storytelling. Not tall tales, but well-told stories of what he had actually seen. He was at his best round a campfire. John listened to my concern about Stinking Springs quietly, then thought it over. He never rushed to answer a question, and you could depend on his answer. "I don't know, Alan," he said. "I think it's all gone. Somebody hauled all the rocks away to build other houses, and the spring has dried up." I told him I was mostly interested in the lay of the ground around the house and that there should be some trace left. Maybe the foundation, broken glass, rusty pieces of iron, to show where the house had been. He drew a map and gave me some names. You remember Fred Fry. When the government closed the post office at Dureno, he moved to Fort Sumner. But you can find him. Be sure to see Ben Hall. He has his father's ranch now. Finding Fred Fry in Fort Sumner was easy. Everyone in town knows everyone else. I had to tell them who I was, but he remembered my parents. Mr. Fry's mail route had taken him past Stinking Springs many times. Sure, he knew where it used to be, but it was gone now. He could show me the site, but he had already been feeling poorly lately and would have to wait until he felt better. He agreed that the rock building had been heavy and must have pressed its foundation rocks into the ground. Some of them should still be there to mark the spot. Ben Hall might be able to tell me more, he thought, and gave me directions to the Hall Ranch by the new road. On the way, I stopped at the Billy the Kid Museum on Fort Sumner's Main Street. It has an impressive collection of Western memorabilia, but the owner, Ed Sweet, could not help me with Stinking Springs. People say it's around Tolar and Tyban, he said. Then I went to the New Mexico State Monument, a quarter mile west of the kid's grave, where old Fort Sumner used to be before the Pecos River dissolved its adobe bricks and washed the clay downstream. Guides Kathy Bradley and Richard Terrell told me about the old fort and the Indians that were imprisoned and starved there, but they could not help me with Stinking Springs. We hope you find it, Terrell said, because lots of tourists ask us where it is. At the Hall Ranch, Ben Hall and a crew of men were busy driving a corral full of cattle through a dipping vat. The job didn't take long, but Ben couldn't help me. It's all gone, he said. I can tell you about where it was, but that's all. There is nothing left to find. He showed me approximately where it had been on my map, and I left to look there, not very hopeful. Soon after my return to California, a letter came from Mr. Fry. With a trembling hand, he wrote that he had been asking questions of his visitors and learned some local stories about the kid, which he passed on to me. On my next trip, he hoped to take me to where Stinking Springs had been. A few months later, Fred Fry, like Dereno, where he had been postmaster for so many years, had become a part of Western history. The Southwest is famous for its friendly people. However, if you go through Billy the Kid country, looking and talking like a writer from California, New York, or some other foreign place, you had better expect to be distrusted. This happened to me one afternoon in 1984 when I entered the only place of business in Tyban, New Mexico, that appeared to be open. It was sort of a combined post office and saloon, and I told the lady in charge that I was writing a book on Billy the Kid and wanted to find the site of Stinking Springs so I could describe the capture accurately. She said that she didn't know, but two men there would, if anyone did. She indicated two men in big hats, boots, and Levi's who had just entered. One of them was Ben Hall, the rancher I had seen the year before. "What do you plan to do?" Ben's friend asked. "Ask us a few questions, then go back and write a pack of lies and blame them all on us?" It appeared this cowboy had been interviewed before. I had a pretty good answer. If I wanted to write lies, I'd stay home and make up my own. Then Ben Hall recognized me and told his friend that I once lived on the old Bacon place. I told Ben that I had not yet found Stinking Springs and had come back to look again. "It's like I told you last year," Ben said. "I used to go there when I was a kid, and I'd know the spot if I saw it. I could probably ride right to it on a horse, but now they've put in roads and fences, and you can't go by trail anymore. Besides, there's nothing to find. Someone hauled away the rocks, and the spring went dry when they started pumping water in Portales." "Do you know where it was, Bert?" Bert Franklin thought it was all gone. We talked a while. Ben had gone to school with some of my cousins, and both men had known the aging De La Vina Maxwell when they were kids. Ben said that Cibolo Arroyo, where Pete Maxwell had dipped his sheep 100 years ago, still smelled of sulfur after summer rains. Bert got his mail in-house, close to where the Yerby Ranch had been when Pat Garrett tried to waylay O'Folliard. "I can tell you how to find Brazil Spring," Ben Hall suggested. "That's still there." He drew a map to Brazil Spring, which was almost as good to me as a map to Stinking Springs. Brazil was one of the ranching partners who pretended friendship with the kid and his gang, but helped Pat Garrett trap them at Stinking Springs. Brazil Spring could help me find Stinking Springs. According to the literature, Stinking Springs was 3 miles east of the Brazil Ranch, which would certainly be by a spring called Brazil. Old newspapers had said that the capture occurred in a rock house at the confluence of the Alamosa and Canadines Creek. My topo map showed the confluence 3 miles east of what it called Tyban Spring. Likely, the office-bound cartographers needed a name for the spring and called it Tyban, but ranchers kept right on calling it Brazil. The pieces were beginning to fit. Brazil Spring was easy to find from Ben Hall's map. It still had a little flow that must have been a large one in 1880. It was about 300 miles from Tyban Arroyo and about 20 feet higher than the arroyo's dry bottom, so it got its water from an aquifer in the nearby mesa, not from the arroyo. There was a large mound of adobe dirt just north of the spring, probably everything left of the 4 or 5 room adobe house Ben Hall remembered from when he was a boy. A few wind-beaten cottonwood trees lined the spring's little pond, and cattails nearly choked its drainage. This must have been what Stinking Springs looked like 100 years ago, before irrigation wells 40 miles away lowered the water table by mining water that had been stored in the Llano for millions of years. Surely this was the site of the Brazil Ranch. Billy the Kid, Charles Baudre, and the others had dressed out stolen beef hanging from trees just like these to take to Fort Sumner the night Tom O'Folliard was killed. These could even be the same trees, since some of the cottonwoods the Indian captives had planted in Fort Sumner still lived. As I considered that, a Santa Fe freight train rumbled by 100 yards to the north, bound for Fort Sumner. I had driven spikes on that very section of track one summer, unaware of the history that had occurred just over the right-of-way fence. Nor did I dream that I would return 50 years later, trying to retrace that history. I watched the train pass, then drove back to Tolar to talk to C.W. Grissom, who owned the land where most people thought Stinking Springs had been. He was a newcomer, having come to breed horses for the Ruidoso racetrack 3 years before, but he knew of Stinking Springs. "People tell me it used to be down in there somewhere," he said, sweeping his hand across a square mile or two of stacked plains. No, he had no objection if I wanted to look for it. He would like to know where it was himself. I thanked him and took my leave, but the sun was already low, and I planned to sleep in Arizona that night. Though there wasn't much time, I felt good about the search. Maybe next year. In 1985, Rene Barker, a hydrologist experienced in finding inactive springs and willing to contribute his time to Western history, and who happens to be my son, went along to help. One cloudy afternoon in August, we stopped at a shop 2 miles east of Tyban that Fred Fry had called the Red Indian. We checked our topo map and asked a man inside the name of the drainage crossing the highway from the north. He said it didn't have a name. Everyone just called it the Arroyo. He did not know where Stinking Springs was, but he had heard it was somewhere in the area. From the Red Indian, we drove south on a dirt road under a railroad overpass, and about a mile farther to the home of the rancher I had seen in 1984. Mr. Grissom was not at home, but I had his permission to look around. We parked our car beside the road in the area we considered most likely, warned each other about snakes, and began the search. I knew we were in the area I wanted to search, but heavy clouds were forming and it was getting late. Renee had to start back to Georgia in the morning. It looked like another maybe next year. Just as I was giving up, Renee called from across a draw. I believe this is where a spring was. Look for a foundation, I shouted and ran toward him. Suddenly, there it was. Renee, I yelled. Here it is, the foundation. There were two indistinct rows of stone slabs embedded to ground level and converging on a point that must have supported the northwest corner of a building. The slabs were all sandstone, probably from an outcrop a half mile away, and set in an alluvial deposit of sandy clay, gravel, and well-rounded cobbles. The foundations of the east and south walls appeared to be gone. Only digging or probing would tell if anything of them remained. No sandstone slabs were loose about the site. Whoever got the rocks wanted them all. The longest wall measured 24 feet and ran east to west. Only about 8 feet of the west wall foundation was visible, but slight changes in the vegetation suggested that its southern end might be buried. On that nearly treeless plain, the width of the building would have been limited to the length of the poles available for vigas to support the roof. The foundation was about 150 feet from where we believed the spring had been, and on a gentle slope descending from northeast to southwest, where it ended in a small arroyo that must have protected Pat Garrett's part of the posse as it approached the sleeping outlaws. There was the mesquite-topped bank of the arroyo that probably sheltered Garrett, Barney Mason, and five other posse men when they shot Charles Baldry and the horse that died in the doorway. The doorway must have faced south, because Garrett wrote that from the bank he was in a position to command a view of the doorway. Also, Alejandro Pereira, who built the house, would have wanted his casa to face the spring and turn its back to the north wind. Stuart and his Texans must have been on the higher ground behind the house. It was all here, a stage for reenactment of the capture, ready for the actors and the cameras. If we went to town and told just anyone the next day, might find several cars of pot hunters on the site, all looking for anything they could dig up. That would ruin the site and violate Rancher Grissom's trust. Renee advised me to tell no one, make sure of my facts, then make a positive and open disclosure of the find. My route back to California took me through Lincoln, where a state official was inspecting reconstruction of the old Murphy store, which became the Lincoln County's courthouse. It is part of the New Mexico State Historical Monument at Lincoln, because the kid escaped from it after his capture at Stinking Springs. I told the official about finding the capture site and suggested that it be marked and protected. If I had found it, I pointed out, someone else could. He gave me his card and asked me to send him the location later. Later was later than expected. There was an accident and the little station wagon rolled many times. Seat belts are not effective when the seats are reclined for sleeping, so I regained consciousness several days later in a Phoenix hospital. Months later, I had recovered enough to do the final work on my book, the Billy the Kid quiz, and get it printed. The little volume carefully described our Stinking Springs find and included our pictures of the foundation and terrain. A few months later, a lady who lives near the capture site wrote to say she had just read my book and finally found someone who thinks like I do. A few days later, she wrote again. A group of people around Fort Sumner were banding together to promote, preserve, and protect the history of Billy the Kid Country, and the state of New Mexico. We did think alike. It was an idea whose time had come. The lady, Marilyn Bolin, is now president of the Billy the Kid Outlaw Gang, which boasts an exploding membership that extends from Hawaii to Europe, and includes even President Reagan. He may be the only legal outlaw in Washington, one Republican quipped. The outlaw gang's first big rendezvous was July 14th through the 16th, 1988, in Old Fort Sumner, where the kid was killed and lies buried. It both rivaled and complemented the old Lincoln Day celebration held annually in Lincoln the first weekend in August. Western writers, early settlers, and others who are especially involved in Western history attended. Not long ago, the Outlaw Gang sent invitations to its members to attend the dedication of a newly erected New Mexico State Scenic Historical Marker. It is beside Highway 6084, 14 miles east of Fort Sumner, and marks the site of Billy the Kid's capture at Stinking Springs. Three television crews from NBC, CBS, and PBS were also present at the dedication. In order to verify the find, excavation had been done under the supervision of state archaeologists. The foundation was found to be deeper than I expected, and the footing of all the walls was exposed, including those of a second small room, or possibly an outside lean-to. The building had been 30 feet long and 12 feet wide. There is no doubt that the place we found is the actual capture site. It has been officially recognized by the state of New Mexico. Janine Grisham, who owns the land with her husband and has a librarian brother-in-law who specializes in rare books, located a photo taken in about 1925 captioned, "Where Billy the Kid Surrendered to Pat Garrett." The foundation in the photo was 63 years newer and far less obscure than it was when we refound it, but the terrain is identical. There is no doubt that they are the same.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.